Thank you for being here. I will preface my remarks with a bit of a confession here this evening. The impetus for this lesson came directly from my confusion as to why I was not seeing more information in the news about Donald Trump being the Antichrist. And I don't say that really by way of criticizing Mr. Trump, believe it or not, because if I suspect, don't know this for sure, I don't know Mr. Trump, but I suspect if you told him that he was being characterized as a hugely powerful, hugely popular figure that people were gravitating toward, and that was dominating by the force of his strength and the force of his presence, and that people were gravitating to him from all over, he'd probably take that as a compliment. And I think that most people, frankly, would take it as a compliment. It's only in the context of the New Testament, really, that this takes on a negative connotation. And by the way, I may have lost some folks already here with my remarks. Let me back up a little bit. One of the reasons I think that perhaps I'm not hearing the kind of chatter that I really kind of might expect is, and I hope this is the case, is that the premillennialism theory, the premillennialism philosophy, the premillennial approach to New Testament study is falling out of favor with people. I don't know if that's the case. I think it might be the case. And if so, I think it's long overdue. For those who don't know what I'm talking about here, premillennialism is a general philosophy of Bible doctrine which states, among other things, that, well, fundamentally it states that the kingdom of Jesus is not fulfilled yet, that it will be fulfilled on earth, that Jesus will physically come to earth and reign in Jerusalem on the throne of David for 1,000 literal years. And this is part of what is oftentimes called end time events. And lumped in with end time events, you also have things such as the rapture and the great tribulation and the battle of Armageddon and things like that. Some of which are talked about in the Bible, some of which are alluded to in the Bible, some of which are not. All that being said, the premillennial theory has been popular to one degree or another for 1,000 years or more, especially the last 75 years, as events in the world seemed to be fitting the premillennial theory very, very well, especially events in the Near East. And it was widely popular in the 70s and 80s, especially as I was growing up, as I was maturing in the faith. It was widely assumed that Jesus' coming was right around the corner. That this was just about it. And there are reasons for that, which we're not going to get into today. And one prophecy after another fell flat. One date after another was not met by the Lord. He kept missing his deadline one time after another. And I have been saying publicly for the last 20 years or so that premillennialism has a shelf life. There's only so many times that we can go down this road and be disappointed. The so-called timeline that's laid out for us in the scripture can only be stretched so far. And we're not going to be able to go a whole lot longer before the entire philosophy is going to have to be scrapped in toto. And it may be that we're getting close to that stage. There are a few holdouts. There are a few books still being sold, still a few high-profile preachers who have their philosophies and their theories and their dates that are being thrown out there, some in the not-too-distant past. But with all that in mind, most of my brethren, if you talk to them straight up about whether they believe in premillennialism, whether they believe that Jesus is not yet king, if they believe he's going to come to earth and live on earth and reign on earth for 1,000 years, pretty much everybody's going to say no. And again, I'm not going to take time to defend that today. But if you ask brethren a more general question about whether we are living in end times right now, I think you get a lot of brethren who are going to say yes. And ironically, for the same, well, maybe not ironically, for the same reason that the premillennialists are also saying that we're living in end times. So what I would like to do for a little bit here today is deal with this question. The question of whether or not we are living in end times today, which is to say, are the events that we're seeing in the news today, what you're seeing on television, reading in the papers and such, are these precursors to biblically prophesied, spiritually centered events that are going to upheave world culture and ultimately end the physical world that we live in now? And this may or may not be the only end time sermon that is being preached tonight in Escambia County. I suspect very strongly that it's going to be the only one who sounds like this. And I'll ask you to take that for what it's worth and bear with me. The question is, are we in end times? I'm going to answer that in two ways. I know that you're used to my three-point outline. I'm only going to have two tonight. I went a little bit over this morning, so we're going to give you two instead of three. The first answer, are we in end times? I don't know. Now, I suppose you're in the mood to go home now, right? It's, well, how to know? What's he doing up there? What are we talking about here? Well, it's a little bit more involved than that. In the first place, the Bible does address the topic of Jesus coming back. We are told that it's going to happen. We're given some information about it. But most of the information that we're given about it is extremely vague. And in fact, it seems to be intentionally vague. The text says in 2 Peter, chapter 3 and verse 10, that the Lord is going to come. And it's a protracted coming. It's been put off for quite a while. Just as the preaching of Noah extended the life of earth back in the flood days. He makes that point in the first part of the chapter. But just as the flood did in fact come, Peter says the day of the Lord will come. And he says it'll come as a thief. Now, I don't know how thieves work in your neighborhood. When thieves come to my neighborhood, my experience is they send me a postcard about 3 months in advance. And they say that, you know, sometime this season, you know, 3-4 months or so, you ought to be on the lookout for some really, really bad stuff. Just thought you might be interested. And then a couple of weeks before the event, I get another postcard saying, whoa, you know, you may or may not have prepared for this, but I'm just about to come and knock on your door and take all of your stuff. And the day before, he calls me on the phone, he texts me, he sends me messages on Facebook saying, tomorrow's the day, I'm going to come and steal all your things. No, it doesn't do that. That's not the way thieves work. Generally speaking, I think if the notion of come as a thief means anything, it means that he comes without notice, without specific reference to time frame. People are going to be caught unaware. People are going to be caught unsuspecting, as it were. Now, there are some indications, perhaps, in the text, in general terms, that we might want to talk about as far as end time things. But as far as looking to the Bible for some kind of timeline, or even beyond timeline, to look for a specific date, a specific day on the calendar that you can circle in red and say, this is the time that he's going to come. Not only does the Bible not support such dates, it doesn't support such philosophy. The entire concept of circling a day on the calendar is contrary to what the New Testament teaches regarding end time events. Now, there are some signs, and we're going to turn around to some passages that are oftentimes attached to the premillennial. The one thing that I'm going to like most about the premillennial theory dying is I don't have to say that word anymore. Premillennial. Matthew chapter 24 is one of these passages. And we're going to read from this passage in a little bit. But there are some very specific... Well, let's read it now. Look at a couple things in Matthew chapter 24. And we're going to bounce around a little bit, maybe. And you might put your finger here. We're going to come back to this text. The text talks about, say, for instance, when you see the abomination of desolation, in verse number 15. Let the reader understand. And that's a very important phrase there. If you have a red letter version, Most of you do, I don't. But most of you do. You may notice that most of this chapter is in red letters, and that little phrase there, let the reader understand, is not. What that's telling you is that the Bible translators and editors, and I think they're correct on this, are saying that those words in parentheses are not words of Jesus. Those are words of Matthew, given by inspiration. And what he's saying is, if you're reading this text, you need to understand what he's saying. Let the reader understand. Now, you may not understand what the abomination of desolation is, but if you were a first century Jew who had been reading the book of Daniel his entire life, heard it read from in the synagogues, you know what the abomination of desolation is, and you'll recognize it when you see it. And I suggest to you in AD 70, when the Roman hordes came in and put up their pagan symbols in the temple, they understood that for exactly what it was. Let the reader understand. And he also says there that those who are in Judea must flee to the mountaintops. Don't go down to the house to get your things, he says. If you're in the field, don't go back to get your cloak. And lots of very specific kind of things. This is what you do when you see these events coming. And I've never quite understood what any of that is going to do to help me if the Lord is coming to end all things. If the Lord is coming to take the righteous and to destroy the wicked, don't even bother going back to the house and getting your coat. Really? What does my coat have to do with anything? Hope that it doesn't come in winter. Well, what difference could it possibly make whether it comes in winter or not? This sounds a lot more like some kind of political, social upheaval, some kind of military event perhaps, rather than an end times event. Well, I suggest to you that's exactly what it is. That he is warning them about specific things to prepare them. Yes, giving them specific indications. Preparing them for Jewish destruction, especially this notion of the abomination of desolation. Now, why would he give them specific things? Why would he give them specific warnings, specific directions? Well, because in those situations, there's going to be some really bad stuff that if they're prepared and if they're motivated, if they read these words and believe them, they might be able to get out of the way. They might be able to miss all these horrible things. And if you read on and look at what bad things are going to come, you're going to want to miss them. You're going to wish that the hills were falling down on top of you, Jesus says, rather than put up with what you're having to put up with. Now, it would stand to reason then that if there is a specific event that those people were to be prepared for, let the reader understand, that they would be given warnings, specific warnings, so they'll know what to miss when it comes time to miss it, rather than what we see with regard to the coming of Jesus, which is going to come as a thief, as it were, if the thief's not going to give you specific warnings to watch out for. Let me also touch on this, the idea of the Antichrist, and if you haven't already, you might flip over to 1 John chapter 2. And this is usually the text that people go to when they want to talk about the term Antichrist, when they want to talk about his activity. They'll usually go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 because that really sounds a lot more premillennial than 1 John chapter 2. The word Antichrist doesn't appear in that text. That's probably significant. But the Antichrist that he's talking about here is not an end-time creature. He's not an end-time character. He is a constant character. He's an ancient character, in fact. Read with me, verse number 18. Children, it is the last hour, and just as you heard that Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists, now that's interesting, many Antichrists, not one, many Antichrists have appeared, past tense, not future tense. From this we know that it is the last hour. They went out from us, but they were not really of us, for if they had been of us, they would have remained with us. But they went out so that it would be shown that they are not all of us. But you have an anointing from the Holy One, and you all know. I have not written to you because you do not know the truth, but because you do know it, and because no lie is of the truth. Who is that liar but the one who denies that Jesus is the Christ? This is the Antichrist, the one who denies the Father and the Son. And we'll just pick up there. Now, you'll notice here in the context, not only is the word Antichrist given to us, but he's also defined fairly well. And if you know your roots, your Greek and Latin roots and such, then you probably pick up on this on your own. Anti, A-N-T-I, the prefix, means against, like antifreeze. It's something that keeps your liquid in your engine from freezing, right? or antibiotics, is stuff that kills bio things in your body, bacteria and that kind of stuff. Well, antichrist is that which is antichrist. It's not going to kill Christ, but it's opposed Christ. And in the specific context of 1 John chapter 2, he's talking about false apostles, those who would claim to be genuine apostles like John, like Paul, like Peter, but who were not, who had gone out from the apostles, who were distancing themselves from apostolic doctrine, from apostolic authority. John says they're doing that because they're against us. They're not on the side of the apostles. And by extension, they are not on the side of Jesus. They are antichrist. And those antichrists in the first century may have had specific doctrines they were holding to, but in a general sense, anyone really who is opposing himself from a position of authority, opposing Jesus, opposing the gospel, is antichrist, or if you prefer, an antichrist. Not a particular individual that we're talking about here. They're just exactly what the term would indicate. They are against Christ. And so the notion, I would suggest to you, of looking for some singular antichrist who is coming in the future to tear everything up and turn it on its ear and set world events in motion and such in fulfillment of Bible prophecy, that's a misunderstanding of what an antichrist is, what an antichrist has always been. As I said before, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 does not contain the word antichrist. It contains the philosophy of antichrist in the minds of most or all, I suppose, premillennial philosophers. He's called in this text the man of lawlessness or the man of perdition. A couple of other terms are given to us there. If you haven't already, you might flip over to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and remind ourselves of a few things that Paul writes about this one. This apostasy is going to come, he says in verse 3. And then the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. Okay, there he is. This fellow's coming, and he's going to be bad news, right? Do you not remember, he says in verse 5, that while I was with you, I was telling you these things. Paul's been warning about this man for some time, he says. And you know what restrains him now, so that in his time he will be revealed. Now, wait a second. Let's think about that for a second. And you know what restrains him now, verse number 6 says. Now, if the man of lawlessness, if the son of perdition is being restrained now, when Paul is writing 2 Thessalonians, back almost 2,000 years ago, this is a very old fella that we're talking about right now, if he's going to be causing trouble in our lifetimes. Because not only was he alive back then, he was already planning his business back then, and he was specifically being restrained. And then it says in verse number 7 again, the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. He who restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way. Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth, etc. Now, there's a lot in that text that I don't want to get into right now, but the main point is this. This force that we're talking about, whether it's a literal person, whether the person represents some kind of larger entity or larger movement or whatever you want to call it, this man here in 2 Thessalonians 2 already existed. He was already at work. He was known to the church in Thessalonica. And he was being restrained from behaving as he wanted to, but he would not be restrained for much longer. And this force that was holding him back would not hold him back any longer. So that is telling us here that this is not a 20th century or a 21st century phenomenon. This is a first century phenomenon, which may or may not have application in the modern day. If you want to take lessons from this regarding the modern day and the modern church, I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad approach. But what we ought to agree on is that 2 Thessalonians 2 was never intended to tell us specifically about end time events. We know that because it is specifically addressing first century events for people who were living there in the first century. Now, all that to say this. The events that we read about in the Bible, the texts, the explanations, the doctrines that are espoused here regarding these things that we've been talking about, the final day, coming as a thief, the Antichrist, the man of lawlessness, none of this was ever intended to give a specific indication of when Jesus is going to come again. And I propose to you that if we're not going to learn it from the Bible, If we're not going to learn it from Jesus, from the inspired apostles, then we're not going to learn it from Hal Lindsey. We're not going to learn it from John Hagee. We're not going to learn it from any other person that's going to come around and tell you about end time events. Any modern day prophet or so-called prophet. That's why I say I don't know. I'm not saying that Jesus is not going to come next week or next month or next year or next decade. I'm not saying that. I don't know. I'm saying I don't know. So are we clear on that? Maybe I need to say that again. I don't know. All right. Point number two. Point number one, I don't know. Point number two, I don't care. Now, that'll need some explanation. I'll explain what I mean by that. I get in trouble sometimes with people when I talk about Bible concepts and I say I don't care. I'm not suggesting I don't care what the Bible teaches on any subject. I'm saying that particulars with regard to end time events, particulars regarding the return of the Lord, do not impact me, do not affect me in my walk with Christ one bit. It makes absolutely no difference whatsoever. I'll explain what I mean by that. Turn with me to Matthew chapter 24, where we were before. Let me read something with you. Matthew chapter 24 is one of these texts that is oftentimes used, including by my brethren, oftentimes, to refer to end time events. I think they're mistaken on that, but that's me. You can make up your own mind on that. Let's say, though, in concept, that it is, or that it might be. Let's see what Jesus has to say with regard to preparation. In Matthew chapter 24, starting verse 45. Who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to put their food at the proper time, to give them the food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and begins to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards, the master of the slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, and an hour when he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Okay, what we have here is a little tactic that is called a parable. Jesus uses a lot of them. He uses a lot of them in Matthew 24 and 25. And many of them have reference to the idea of what we do with regard to accountability. And we'll talk about accountability in a second. But this text says that because the Lord is coming, and again, assign to that whatever meaning you want. Because the Lord is coming, the wise slave, the wise one who has been given some responsibility is going to be dutiful in his responsibility. He's going to do what the master told him to do. Now, is he going to do that on the day that he thinks his master is going to come? Or is he going to do that every day? Well, since the text specifically talks about him coming in a day that he doesn't know, he's going to do that every day. That's the smart thing. This is part of our preparations. We realize that while we are here on earth, we have responsibility to our brethren. We have responsibility to one another. I think that's a large part of what he's meaning here. And he takes the opportunity of the destruction of Jerusalem to talk about preparedness in a general sense. Now, if you want to say he's applying this to end time events, I don't want to argue with you on that. The general point here is this. If Jesus is talking specifically about the destruction of Jerusalem, if he's talking specifically about end time events, if he's talking broadly about both things, the lesson remains the same. No matter which explanation you have, what we're left with is, I need to care for my brethren. I need to serve my brethren. And since I was going to do that anyway, what difference does it make from a practical standpoint whether this is talking about end time events? If it is, well, then I guess I'd better be about the task of serving my brethren. Well, if I was going to do that anyway, then it doesn't make any difference. That's why I'm saying that I don't care. One way or the other. You can take either explanation from this text. Either way, we come back with the notion that we are going to have to serve our brethren. So whether Jesus comes today, whether he comes next week, next month, whether you have some notion in your head that he's going to come on a particular date at a particular time, whatever. Either way, the message comes back, I need to be ministering, taking care of, prioritizing my brethren. Similarly, let's talk about lawlessness.
And go back to the text in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. We read this text before. We'll read a little bit of it again. I think we left off at verse number 8. 2 Thessalonians 2:8. Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring it in by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, and with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. And it goes on to talk about this deluding influence that the Lord's going to send and such things. And somebody says, well, how are you saying that that's not talking about end time events? No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it doesn't make any difference. Because the text is saying here in this context that delusion is going to come into the world. That there's going to be a powerful force who's going to try to drag you away from the truth. Trying to drag you away from a strict adherence to God's word and encourage you to engage in lawlessness. Now, at what point does it become important for you to not do that? At what point does it become important to not give in to this trend toward lawlessness? We're going to wait for end time events to do that? No, that's good advice every day of every year, isn't it? And so in that sense, again, we wind up in the same place. We wind up emphasizing the need for us to examine everything carefully, to hold to that which is good, as Paul told the Thessalonians in his first letter. It's necessary for us to do that. And again, whether you're talking about one particular high-profile individual who's trying to drag you off into error, or whether you're talking about the preacher who's in your pulpit right now who's not teaching the truth, or some preacher you may have heard of or you're thinking about having fellowship with, or whatever. Regardless of who it is, if he is advocating a gospel other than the gospel that Jesus advocates, that the gospel that the apostles advocated, that person is preaching lawlessness and he needs to be rejected, regardless of how much time may be on the earth's clock, as it were. Thirdly, I was going to prepare myself to be held accountable anyway. This is perhaps the most central lesson behind all of these end-time things. If the Lord really is going to come, if the Lord really is going to destroy all things, and if he's really going to separate the righteous from the lawless and elevate the righteous and destroy the lawless, then I better make sure I'm on the right side of that, right? I better make sure I'm on the right side of that dividing. Well, when do you do that? When do you start preparing for accountability? Well, you got your good students and you got your mediocre students, right? We have some teachers in the house. They know what I'm talking about. There are some students who realize that at the end of the term, there's going to be a big test and there's going to be a grade, and that grade is going to have a great deal to do with whether or not the child is going to advance. That's the way it worked in my time anyway. And therefore, they need to spend the intervening 18 weeks getting ready for the big test. And there are other students who will hem and haw and procrastinate and drag their feet and waste 17 and a half weeks and then decide, I didn't need to be prepared before. I'm going to start preparing right now. 48 hours from the final exam. There are some people who will adhere very strictly to both of those philosophies, whether you're talking about college, high school, junior high, whatever. Which one is a better philosophy? And if you ask the teachers, I'm sure they will all, to a person, tell you that it's better to prepare all the way along. And to encourage the students to prepare all the way along, they will pull a really nasty trick every once in a while. They will throw at the students what they used to call a pop quiz. Any of you ever have to, y'all do the pop quizzes every once? Yes, that's right. Now, what is that? That's, in theory anyway, sometimes the teachers aren't quite this hard, but in theory what this is some kind of quick on-the-spot assessment of how prepared they are. No warning at all. Just, hey, today we're going to have a quiz. What? I wasn't ready. Well, you're supposed to be ready. I told you 6 weeks ago that we were going to have pop quizzes every once in a while. You need to be yes, but I didn't really believe you. Well, that's not my problem, young man. Here, you're going to have to fill out this test. It happens sometimes. And what it ought to do is encourage ongoing readiness. It may or may not succeed in that.
But that's the idea. Anyway, so that you would encourage yourself to be ready at all times. That's what Jesus is trying to do for us. It's not just a matter of making sure that by the time Jesus finally gets around to appearing on earth, that we're all ready for it. And if we know we have 5 years until that date, well, you got, you know, 4.5 years, 4 years and 8 months, whatever, to kind of do whatever you want. But then right there at the end, we really better bear down and make sure that we get this right. Don't tell me you wouldn't do that. I'm telling you I would do that. That's the human nature. If we knew for a fact there was a finish line, we'd start getting ready toward the finish line. I'm persuaded that's why Jesus doesn't give us specific warnings about end times things, so that we will be ready on an ongoing basis. Again, back in Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24 and starting in verse number 42. Therefore, be on the alert, Jesus says, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Now, that has obvious applications to end time events. That has obvious applications to the second coming and the destruction of all things. And if you want to say that specifically what Jesus is talking about, again, I don't care to have that discussion today. That's fine. But let's accept, at least in general terms, what Jesus is saying here is that regardless of what kind of judgment we're looking at, regardless of what kind of punishment or reckoning or whatever is going to be called upon, is going to be ushered out by the Lord, we have to be ready not just when we think it's about to arrive, but at all times, because the bottom line is we don't know when it's going to arrive. And so therefore we need to be prepared to be held accountable at all times, and not held accountable in terms necessarily of standing before the Lord and accounting for our entire life, although obviously that's involved. We also need to be accountable for the things that we do every single day of our lives. The everyday decisions that you make. How much you're going to read the Bible this week. How much you're going to pray. Whether you're going to come back to Bible study on Wednesday night. Whether you're going to prioritize spiritual things. Whether you're going to say no to temptation. Whether you're going to laugh at the nasty jokes that are being told, or whatever it happens to be this week, that's going to give you an opportunity to show yourself to be either on the side of the Lord or not on the side of the Lord. Are you going to be accountable in that day? Well, you need to consider yourself accountable, because the bottom line is you are accountable. And you may be held accountable by the Lord on that day as well. One more time in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Same kind of thought here. Paul talks to the Thessalonians a lot about this day of the Lord. The phrase comes up multiple times, especially in the first letter. And they are very concerned about time frame. And Paul tries to get them away from the idea of time frame. Now, as to the times and epochs, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you, for you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just as a thief in the night. Well, while they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly, like labor pains upon a woman with child, and they will not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, that the day would overtake you like a thief, for you are all sons of light and sons of day. We are not of night nor of darkness, so then let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober. For those who sleep do their sleeping at night, and those who get drunk at night. But since we are of the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation. For God has not destined us for wrath, but he's for obtaining salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we are awake or asleep, we will live together with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build one another up, just as you are doing. You ask, how are you saying that 1 Thessalonians 5 is not talking about going to heaven? You say it's not talking about judgment day. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it's talking about accountability. And you can make application toward the day of judgment. I think it's totally appropriate. You can make application in any number of other areas as well. What he's saying is you need to be alert. You need to be paying attention to what's going on. Not put off your preparation until later. Not just sleep late, keep hitting the snooze button until you're ready to be held accountable. No, you be held accountable now. You go ahead and answer to God now for the things you're doing. And if you can't answer to God for the things you're doing now, then make things right. Fix things. Come into compliance with His will, if at all possible, in any way that might be necessary. That's what we're going to be doing. And this is why I say here, I don't care. I'm not suggesting that I'm not interested at all in whether the Lord is going to come today or tomorrow or next week. I'm saying that a person who has given his life over to Jesus Christ, a person who has committed himself to the faith, is going to live the kind of life that a Christian would live at all times. One of the things that I took away from college, one of the great things about college is you forget most everything. But every once in a while, the professor says something that really sticks with you. And one of the things that was said to me, and it was a literature professor, I think, English lit, in my sophomore year, I think. He said that one of the age-old questions in life is, what would you do if this were your last day on earth? And he said the only really good answer to that question is, I would do exactly what I would have done anyway. And I said, that makes sense. I like that. I'm not sure I'm quite up to that. I'm not sure I'm quite to that stage yet, but that's where I ought to be. I ought to be living the life that I want to live, that I know is right for me to live. And if it's the last one, I'm going to live it for Jesus. I'm going to be a good example for Him. I'm going to be accountable for the choices that I'm making. Not any more than I would have otherwise, because I'm already giving 100% to the Lord, and I don't have any more than 100%, no matter what your little league coach told you. There's no more than 100%. And if we're giving Jesus 100%, that's all He can ask of us. All these things being said, there is going to come a time when we're going to be held accountable before the Lord. And it may be tomorrow. It may be next week, next month, next year. I don't know. The important thing is not to find out when that day is. The important thing is to get ready today, just in case it is today. Because regardless of whether Jesus comes for your soul tonight or not, you are accountable to your God. And God is one day, maybe too late for you, going to ask you, or too early for your taste anyway. He's going to ask you to give an account for the things that you've done. If you need to make your life right with God, if you are not accountable for the things you've done, but you want to be, you want to give account, you want to be right with God, you want to be forgiven of sin, we want to help you in whatever way we possibly can. If there's some way that we can help you walk with Christ more perfectly so that when that day comes, you'll be on the right side instead of on the left. Please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing at this time.